From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nam. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst and contributing writer for Washington City Paper. Tom Sherwood joins us in studio. Tom Sherwood, welcome to studio. Good to see you again.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. I'll tweet out a picture of Kojo, who is separated from me by a big plexi screen. And our guest will be not here in the studio, but on the phone.
They definitely will be on the phone with us. But my, you look younger since this time has passed over the past year. What have you been doing?
I think, staying inside my apartment, I have faded. I get no sun, I get no exercise. I'm just fading away.
But you have not been beaten up by the elements. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking with Justin Wilson, the mayor of the city of Alexandria. But joining us now is Mark Elrich, county executive of Montgomery County. Mark Elrich, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Sorry that Tom is fading.
If you have comments or questions for Mark Elrich, you can call us at 800-433-8850. Before we get specifically to Montgomery County, Tom Sherwood, Metro will require COVID vaccines, weekly testing for employees. Just about 45% of Metro workers are fully vaccinated. But because of the spike in the coronavirus related to the Delta strain, what we're seeing is various agencies and governments and school systems asking for masking and proof of vaccination or testing all around.
Yes, not only all of that, but private industry too. Initially, this was basically a federal government trying to get the states to go along. And now, more than a year into it, people are taking it upon themselves, agencies and private businesses, to tell the people who are either hesitant or recalcitrant to say, if you want to participate in society, you want to do the things we're doing, you must be masked or you must have weekly tests and you must be vaccinated. And so Metro has something like 12,000 employees and contractors that will have to provide proof of their COVID vaccines or submit to weekly tests. And that's really important for all the people, because Metro also is, lowering some fares soon to $2 on weekends to get more people to ride. And the federal rule is, and the Metro rule is, passengers will have to wear masks on the Metro system. It's not clear how that will be enforced, but hope there'll be herd mentality. People will see people with masks, and they'll wear them.
And D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser is insisting on requiring students in classrooms, but the District of Columbia is also insisting on masking for teachers, students, and other school personnel. We'll get to what's going on in Montgomery County in a second.
Yes, and again, this is like many other school systems, except for the ones who are bonehead ones in some southern states. But the people, leaders, parents, educators want students back in school. The mayor has said, despite the Delta variant, that this is a time to get the students in class. They've lost over a year already. It's an imposition maybe to wear a mask. It's an imposition to require the employees to get vaccinated. But the teachers union went along with it a week or so ago. And if you get the students back into the school, there might be, she says, a bump up in infections. But the city knows far more than what it did before. And so let's get the students back in the schools. Let's protect them and the staff there. And let's get on with educating our children.
Mr. County Executive, what is your view on getting children back into schools? What is your view on requiring masking? What is your view on requiring either vaccinations or testing? And you have 10 seconds to answer.
It's so unfair.
Welcome. Look,
I'm in line with Tom, and with the mayor. We are, the schools are going to go back masked. Teachers are going to be either vaccinated or tested. Our employees are either going to be vaccinated or tested. I've talked to folks in the business world. They're beginning to, particularly in restaurants, think about vaccinating or testing proof to get in the door. I tried to point out to them that, with Montgomery County, 85% of our population over the age of 12 is vaccinated. from a business perspective, they would be better off requiring vaccinations because 85 of us can go there. I've got 91% that are partially vaccinated, so you know where our number is going to wind up around 90. You could have 90% of the available customer base, but people are staying out of restaurants because they don't know who's vaccinated and who's not vaccinated.
Well, listen,
and they're worried about it.
Well, and well, they should be. You're connecting with us today from the beautiful Ocean City, Maryland, where the county association, state county association, is having its annual meeting. What are you seeing there? There's a big crab feast this afternoon. There's a lot of conference meetings. People are out and about. What is the mask wearing proportion that you're seeing there in Ocean City?
It's a little uneven. In here, there are clearly people who wear masks all the time, and there are people who don't seem to wear masks at all. And when you go out, to a few places we've been, I haven't been, up and down the boardwalk or anything, but in the restaurants or folk where people are around here, you see a mix. But it's just kind of disturbing. Walking down the street, you hardly see anybody in the mask when you're driving around and looking at groups of people. Now, maybe when they get into a room with other people, they put one on, but this is one of the places that spiked when the governor opened it up, last summer. And no sooner did it open it up than it spiked. And the numbers on the Eastern Shore, particularly down here, are not good. This is a red zone area.
Let me ask you this question. The big event of this county meeting is obviously the work, but tonight is the big crab feast. Are you going to the outdoor crab feast tonight, or will you be doing something else?
Well, I'm going only because it's outdoor.
and because they're crabs.
Actually, only eat crab meat. I've never been able to open up a crab and take the meat out. So if somebody does that for me, I can eat it, but I just can't do it myself.
Okay, that's the headline for today.
Dare call yourself a Maryland?
Elrich can't pick a crab.
You've lost some votes in Montgomery County, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Briefly, can you tell us, for the members of our audience who may not know, what is the Maryland Association of Counties Conference all about, and are you seeing masking among participants in the conference?
Like I said, it's very mixed. I was in a big county meeting, and everybody, the executives and their staff, everybody was masked. But I've been in other meetings where the masking is kind of uneven. I will say that some of the meetings have been a lot less full than they have been in other years. I know people, for example, from my staff who had younger children who did not come down this year, and I heard that from other people, that people who had young family were not going to join their staff or, join the county contingent here because they don't want to take a risk on, getting infected and bringing it back to their families. So, it's had a negative effect, but I've seen plenty of people here who do not have masks on.
Mr. County Executive Dr. Travis Gales, the Montgomery County Health Officer, resigned this week, effective next month. What was your response to that news? I knew he called you at about 9 o'clock our time from a telephone in France, where he is apparently vacationing. But what was your response to the news?
Well, I'm obviously not happy about it because he was, I think, a really great leader. He was one of the health officers in the state that was able to continually stand up to Hogan and Hogan's ill-informed recommendations on how to handle the virus. And, he's in a difficult position because he actually has two bosses. I don't think a lot of people realize this. But that health officer position is a pick that we forward to the state, and the state either concurs or we don't get our pick. And so he put himself at odds with the governor for 18 months. And that has to be hard. And when you add in having to battle with the governor and his folks, but then to have to take the kind of racist and homophobic stream of email he got, I got to see some of it, and it was just horrifying. It's like you're trying to save people's lives, and the thanks you get as a governor who doesn't want you to do what you're doing, and people who insult you in every way possible, and clearly people who don't know anything about public health. So I think he had a very hard and not very fun year doing this.
The Kaiser Health Foundation, I forgot the official name, says that more than 250 ranking public health officials, some state health directors, others lower level, have walked away from their jobs, many of them because of the pressure of all this. It just seems odd to a lot of people, though, that you've got a email that was sent at 9 o'clock in the morning, France time. He's on vacation in France, and Dr. Gale sent the email. Had you been told in any way in advance that this was going to happen, or did he go on vacation, wake up, find himself in France, maybe had a bottle of wine the night before and thought, why am I still doing this? And he quit. How did it happen?
I don't know yet. I mean, he's still there. I'm not going to
interrupt. So he didn't tell you
vacation.
Before you got the email?
No, I didn't know before.
He sent the email to you and the council members. Very odd.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, I feel for him. You know, you can't look at what he went through and not, you know, get a sense that, you know, to do that kind of work and be under that kind of pressure to make the right decision, which is a whole different set of pressure, and then to be subject to the kind of attacks he was put through, just is not very rewarding.
Well, as Tom pointed out, there are health officers around the nation who are resigning. But of course, these are people who, because of the coronavirus, have to work 7 days a week, often at odd hours of the day and night when they are called upon. So there's clearly a lot of pressure there. You pointed out that Dr. Gales is responsible for responding to two bosses. What's the process in appointing a health officer, a county health officer?
So we're going to, you know, do a search firm and take recommendations, and we'll interview who we think are the best candidates. And the state's asked to, you know, to be included, not simply told at the last minute. So we'll let them know the candidates that we're thinking about. I met with the secretary yesterday. I made it very clear that I'm looking for a health officer who can assure me that, number one, he'll be independent, and number two, I will get strictly medical decisions from him. And like my relationship with Travis was, I never interjected politics. I told him I never would suggest something political to make this more palatable, that whatever his recommendations were, that's what I was going to do. And I'll tell any candidate for this job that that's how I'm going to continue to operate. And I don't want anybody in that job making political calculus about what's acceptable or not. That's my job. And I'm not going to make a political calculus that overrides health calculus.
Whether he or she gets the job, yeah. If you appoint someone, does the state health agency have veto power over that, or does it just need to know?
No, they have to approve.
They have to approve. Okay.
Yes, which is why I made it clear to the secretary that this is what I'm going to send you. I am not going to send somebody who is going to put the state above what they think medical advice is.
Here is Fred.
And since
Germantown,
I know the most
Maryland.
In medical, pardon me?
I was about to go to a phone call, but please finish your comment.
Good. I was going to say, you know, we knew from talking to Dr. Gales, and I knew from talking to health officers and other health advisors, that the governor was not necessarily listening to the health advice, that there was a great discrepancy between what health officers thought and what the governor thought. So I don't want somebody who's going to default to the governor. I want somebody who's going to give me a health decision if I wind up back in the situation where we're doing executive orders, that if he's going to give me an opinion that is the opinion that will keep people the safest. And that's the opinion I want to hear. I don't want to hear that, you know, the state government doesn't want us to do this. I really don't care at this point.
Here's Fred in Germantown, Maryland. Fred, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm in my 60s, live in Germantown, and during the pandemic had to call the call center, the COVID call center for the county. And I found out, surprisingly, it was staffed by the school nurses. They pivoted from staffing the schools and were there 24/7, and it was just fantastic. And that I think, showed good work on their part, because we know that nurses are the Swiss Army knives of the community health workers. And I think that Dr. Gales has done a great job, and I think we need to continue to support Mr. Elrich and thank Dr. Gales. Regarding those school nurses, I found out more about them because I just was interested in it as a taxpayer. And they apparently, with the schools going back in March, had agency nurses that came in. And the agency nurses weren't particularly trained in pediatrics and weren't experienced school nurses. So I just want to get the point across to the county leaders that we need to support our schools and the health of our students. And key to that is supporting the school community health nurses.
What leads you to believe that they might not be supported? Do you think they're not adequately compensated?
That's a big part of it. I'm in healthcare, and a nurse can certainly make more money at a hospital than they can with the county.
Let's see what the county executive has to say about that, Mr. Edwards.
Thank you.
Well, you know, we had a pool of school nurses who obviously were available to us to do all this other things that they were doing. And when we started to reopen stuff and kids, you know, becoming more engaged in the school, that obviously put stress on our resources. Going forward, you know, the school nurses who are, you know, part of, I think, McGeo Union, actually, they will be back in the schools as they were before. And, you know, we're finding, you know, we're hiring other people to provide the kind of supplementary services we're going to need. We know, because we're going to now be going into round three of the vaccinations, that we're going to have to be able to support the vaccination program the same way we're able to do it. And that'll just mean additional outside resources, because the school nurses will be in school and they will not be available for some of the other things we use them for.
Because this is the politics hour, we will get back to municipal and county issues, but Montgomery County Council President Tom Hucker has announced plans to run for county executive in 2022. Many people considered him a close ally of yours on a variety of issues, and he says you have a friendly relationship. What's your reaction to his running, and feel free to be unfriendly?
You know, I just think ultimately it helps David Blair, which ought to be the antithesis of what anybody who says they're progressive would get involved in. We have disagreements about some things, obviously. And I'm a big believer that, you know, you actually, to solve a problem, you actually have to understand the problem. And you just don't react to something with a headline and then say, damn it, we're going to do something, because we have a record of doing things and then what we do doesn't necessarily solve the problem. So, you know, I confess that, you know, I've, you know, worked hard with, you know, both community groups, for example, and with the study group to reform county policing. It's not simply as a matter of just ordering people to do stuff. I think people who think orders are the way you do things, if you don't understand the underlying problem and you react to what you see on the surface, orders probably don't address the underlying problem. So I'm happy you're taking a little bit slower approach to get to the right place. I'm not as, you know, I don't think I'm as volatile as reactive to things. We just have different styles.
Yeah, you certainly do. But is Tom Hucker term limited on the council? Does he have to run for something else or leave the council? Or is he in his third term? I can't remember.
He would be going into his third term. So,
okay, he could run for re-election.
Yeah,
well, you've got Hans Rainer running. You've got two of the council members, and David Blair, of course, is the businessman who's running again and barely lost to you last time around. When are you doing your campaign kickoff? I know you've told us you're running for re-election, but do you have a schedule of when that's going to be, when you're going to stand up in front of your cheering supporters and say, let's go?
One of the things we're debating is how many cheering supporters we're going to stand up in front of, because COVID has kind of messed up this idea of bringing cheering people together. So we're planning an event right now. We are getting ready to start our first fundraising.
Okay.
You know, I felt during COVID it was really not really appropriate. It's still COVID time. That when you're dealing with a crisis, not a great moment to say I'm running for re-election, because becomes re-election.
We'll have a couple more political questions. County Council Member Craig Rice is term limited. He's over in Ocean City with you. He's walking around. He said he's hinted he might run for governor, he might run for this or run for that. Do you have any sense whether he would run for county executive, or has he ruled that out?
I don't have a sense of that. I don't think he is, but, you know, he and I've also, you know, been talking about a number of things we want to work on together.
Okay.
So you know, we've had a really constructive relationship.
Okay, well, obviously you've had your difficult times with Governor Hogan. You're looking forward to the election next year. Have you chosen a Democrat in the growing field there whom you'll support for the primary next year?
Let's put it this way. There's no Democrat who wouldn't be better than the Republicans.
Okay, good.
So I'm going to be very careful about how I go about doing this, because the last thing I want to do is to contribute to doing damage to somebody who's going to ultimately have to stand up and run against Hogan.
Okay, one last political question.
Hogan, but against the Republican.
Governor Hogan was on the boardwalk with Michael Steele and other Republicans and other elected officials yesterday. Have you, A, run into Governor Hogan? Will you attend his speech tomorrow as he concludes the county association convention? Will you try to talk to him there, or is the gap too wide?
No, we've got a meeting with Governor Hogan, and I will talk to him, and I'll, you know, raise questions at the meeting. But, you know, I've said this all along. We met with the State Transportation Department when I came down here. We had a really constructive meeting. I mean, if you take the fight over 270 out of this, we actually work really well with their transportation people. And his folks in all his departments, whether it's housing or health and human services, they've always worked with us, despite the fact that the governor and I have disagreements. Me and my staff were able to work with the governor's staff and move things forward. So it's one of the things I appreciate about his style has been the willingness to work on stuff even when you don't agree about everything.
Well, you mentioned I-270, so that allows me to bring David from Germantown, Maryland, into the conversation. David, go ahead, please.
Well, thank you, and good afternoon, Mr. County Executive. So Larry Hogan, and with the help of Peter Francho, successfully outmaneuvered the opponents to the I-270 toll lanes and got it approved by the Public Works Board. And with the proposed tolls of $1.50 a mile, meaning it will cost $15 to get from Gaithersburg to the Beltway, which is well beyond the capability of the middle-class families that are out in the outer suburbs of Gaithersburg, Germantown,
okay, and this is leading to a question. Can we get to it?
So in the past, you have provided constructive opposition to the I-270 toll lane project. Are you continuing in that effort, and how can interested folks support you in that?
So I am continuing, and people need to know that they still need concurrence of the local planning agencies, and I'll just say good luck with that. They still got to get through the environmental study. That's going to be interesting. So I think people need to continue to pressure people to think about what they've done. You know, the council, you know, reversed its position, but only after they did enough damage at the transportation board that enough other counties looked at that and said, well, you know, your council feels happy, so go ahead and do it. This was really unfortunate. The other thing that I'm doing, and I've raised it with the folks yesterday, if you look at 270 down toward Montrose and Falls Road, they actually added another lane because that space was already available. I've asked them to look at the 270 corridor from Frederick at least down to the ICC, because they could actually add another lane. This is one of those roads that has a concrete shoulder inside and out, and they could take the inside shoulder, which runs most of the way down 270, okay, and use that as a third lane now. So I'm pushing on a solution that won't cost very much, but it'll get folks in the north some traffic relief before 2030.
1 minute left, Tom.
Sure. Very, very quickly, whoever's the Democratic nominee, are you hoping he or she will be more supportive of you and your idea for the 495 and 270?
Well, it's not just my idea.
Condition of your support. I'm talking about you.
Oh, condition of my support? If they're not, they're going to have a damn good package of everything else in the universe that needs to be
done. Do you rule out the comptroller, Peter Francho? They voted against your interests?
I have not ruled out anybody yet.
I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. Our guest, we've been talking with Mark Ehrlich. He is the county executive of Montgomery County. Mark Ehrlich, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, as always.
Next up is Justin Wilson, the mayor of the city of Alexandria. I'm Kojo Nambi. Welcome back. Joining us now is Justin Wilson, the mayor of the city of Alexandria. Mayor Wilson, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's great to be here.
Tom Sherwood, before we get specifically to the city of Alexandria, we should mention that the big news in Washington yesterday was the bomb threat to Capitol Police from an individual from North Carolina who apparently drove his truck in front of the Supreme Court.
Library of Congress. Yes, and up onto the sidewalk. I'm a little concerned about, you know, with all the Capitol Hill Century stuff up there, he apparently sat on the sidewalk
for quite a couple of moments.
I know that I once stopped at the LaGuardia Reservoir to take a picture of a pretty shot, and within like 90 seconds, there was a cop there from the reservoir saying, "What are you doing?" So that was a surprise, but it ended peacefully. 5 hours of shutdown. I was up near around the shutdown area. 5 hours, the negotiations worked. The man surrendered. He had done quite a rant for the while about conservative things, the country being lost, wanting to speak to the president. Clearly some issues there, but the good news is for Capitol Hill Police Chief Tom Manger, his first significant event, it ended well.
People talk around the country about Florida man, because Florida man has become a watchword for people who do stuff. In D.C., it looks like
it's going to be... But this was a North Carolina man.
I'm saying in D.C., it looks like it's going to be North Carolina man, right? Because it was a man who drove from North Carolina to the Comet Pizza here on Connecticut Avenue some years ago and started with...
If I can just say very quickly, my fear is that this incident will give ammunition, to use a word, for people who want to put up a permanent fence around the Capitol. I hope it doesn't happen.
And of course, there is a, when we were talking about masking mandates around the region, there is, needless to say, a congressman from another state, from a state, because the District of Columbia hasn't yet gotten statehood, who would like to prevent D.C. from instituting a vaccine mandate. What business, may I ask, is that of the Representative Pat Fallon of Texas, Republican?
Well, this is, my personal opinion, this is a pretty bonehead move by the congressman, who was a waste of time, whatever he thinks about whether the D.C. should be, have masks locally. He has no power in the Democratic-controlled Congress. Eleanor Holmes Norton will flick this away like a piece of dust on her jacket. This is not going to have anything, but it's another example of how, not being a state and with the ultimate authority over the district by the U.S., by the Congress, these members of Congress from around the country think they can do anything to the people of local Washington. Disrespectful, not going to happen.
And this, I know, will be of interest to Mayor Wilson. Virginia's Bipartisan Redistricting Commission is having trouble with bipartisanship. They could not agree on hiring a single law firm to draw the state's new political boundaries, so they have hired two law firms, one Democrat.
Yes, and hiring two firms. You know, this is the key point here. People wanted more of a less partisan redistricting. So they have what they call a nonpartisan commission. It's bipartisan. It's equal Republican and Democrat, and they don't agree on much. They have different lawyers. They're now going to have different proposals. They have to submit it within 45 days. The legislature could be hamstrung. The Supreme Court of Virginia may end up drawing the lines. The key issue for the mayor to address is that the census was late, the numbers were late, the state delegate and Senate positions have to be redrawn. What is your concern, Mayor, that this could disrupt whoever's going to represent the city of Alexandria in Richmond at the General Assembly?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm disappointed to see the first couple steps of this commission. I supported this commission. I think it was a step in the right direction. It's not perfect, albeit, and I think we're seeing some of the challenges that many feared. I'm hopeful that the two parties will come together and ultimately craft a process that comes up with fair lines. I think, you know, I think the voters were really clear in the election, on the referendum on this, that they wanted to see that direction, and hopefully this commission will get over these hurdles and get moving in a direction that can come up with fair districts around our state.
Well, speaking of politics, I don't think you've been on the program since you won your renomination in June for a second term, beating former Mayor Allison Silberberg 57-43%. Are we going to see any debates with your Republican opponent, Annetta Catchings, who has very little background in politics?
None have been scheduled so far. I would welcome the opportunity to have those debates if organizations want to schedule them, and I hope they will. So I always enjoy that opportunity, and looking forward to facing the voters again this November.
And before we get to serious issues, have you where are you in the governor's race? I know you're a Democrat. I know you're supporting Terry McAuliffe now because he's the nominee.
Are you suggesting that the governor's race is not a serious issue?
Right now it isn't, compared to many other things. But I'm just wondering, Glenn Youngkin is the Republican candidate, and it's widely thought that he needs to tap in and hold down McAuliffe's votes in Northern Virginia. Not to win, because he can't win in Northern Virginia, but he could hold down the votes for McAuliffe and maybe get some for himself. Do you see any evidence that Mr. Youngkin is trying to reach out to the voters in Alexandria?
I've not certainly seen evidence of that. I think Governor McAuliffe is very well thought of in the city of Alexandria. His tenure is one that is extremely popular with the residents of our city, and we'll be working very hard to turn out the vote for Governor McAuliffe this November to bring him back as our governor. I don't think that the message that Mr. Youngkin is attempting to sell is going to play particularly well in Northern Virginia, and certainly not in the city of Alexandria.
We had planned to talk about flooding that you have dealt with in Alexandria today, and today we are again getting torrential rains and flash floodings in flash flood warnings in the region. You are joining us from Vermont, where you are vacationing with your family, and I was tempted to ask, what did you know and when did you know it?
But did there a hurricane come up in that direction?
To keep things serious, how, as far as you know, are things today in Alexandria?
You know, based on all the context I've had this morning, it looks like we did okay this time. I think where we get dangerous, where we have real problems, is when the intensities get to a level that's beyond what our storm sewer system can support. And fortunately, we didn't reach those points this morning. So I haven't heard any significant reports this time. Obviously, last Saturday, Saturday night over into Sunday, was devastating for so many of our residents. We had... In some areas of our city, nearly 5 inches in an hour, and that's a level that our storm sewer system just is not built to sustain and cannot sustain. And unfortunately, we had far too many of our residents who dealt with devastating damage. And for many of them, this is the fourth time in 2 years, and that we've had these kind of events come through our city. And it's just it adds to the urgency for our city to address some of these major infrastructure challenges that we face in many neighborhoods of our community.
It can be
It
could be billions of dollars. I know the district was ordered by the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, to spend, and it is spending, billions of dollars to do holding tunnels under the river, and it's working, but it's very expensive. Do you have a program underway to separate out your sewer and wastewater and storm water runoff system? It's all in the same pipes.
Yeah, well, it's in Old Town. It is so. Unfortunately, in Alexandria, we're dealing with three really separate water issues that we're working through. What you're referencing is our combined sewer issue, same as DC's having, and that's really an Old Town specific issue for us. And we're spending about $500 million between now and 2025 to address that issue. And we'll be basically working to add detention tunnels under Old Town to address those issues. Right now, when it rains about 100 days a year, we are frequently overflowing, and that's raw sewage mixed with rainwater that's overflowing into the Potomac River. And so we'll have that mitigated, hopefully on schedule by 2025, and that work is underway today. Separate from that, what we've been hearing from our residents, what I was referencing over the last 2 years, has been storm sewer deficiencies that we have in our community. And last year, the city council voted to double our stormwater utility fee, which more than doubled the amount of money we now have set aside over the next 10 years to address our storm sewer capacity. And so we'll be spending $200 million alone just on storm sewer capacity over the next 10 years, with about $136 million of that happening in the next 5 years. And we're working to do everything that we can to accelerate those projects best we can. We actually just allocated nearly $6 million of our rescue plan money to help accelerate some of that work. And we're trying to throw everything we possibly can in addressing these things as quickly as possible. But unfortunately, as we see these more intense, more frequent storm events, it's not going to be soon enough for a lot of our residents. And so we're working with our residents to try to look at how we can partner to build resiliency on individual properties in the short term to try to buy us some more time while we try to implement those big infrastructure projects as quickly as we can.
You mentioned residents. Homeowners say they bear the brunt of the effect of floods, since the floods can damage their homes, leading to costly repairs. Leslie sent us an email saying, are you able to identify exactly how many homeowners or renters in Alexandria that have been impacted by the past few years of massive flooding and devastation to property, and the estimated total cost to those affected? This would include the loss of vehicles or other personal property, which is significant. What can you do specifically to help homeowners and renters?
Yeah, so as far as the overall count, we do have a count of the number of folks who are impacted by each of these events. Unfortunately, each one is different. We've had four of these events now in the last 2 years that have far exceeded the capacity of our storm sewer system, and they're not uniform across the city. And unfortunately, each one has different areas where we see higher rain events. This year, we saw the highest totals very close to George Mason Elementary. Last year, they were in different places in our city. Where we saw much higher totals. And it's just the nature of Mother Nature, where not consistently hitting the community the same way. And the totals can range by many inches just within the city and just within a couple hundred yards of each other. Each of these storm events, we also try to estimate the value of impact to the caller's or the emailer's reference. We try to estimate the value, and we do that to determine whether we qualify for different federal and state disaster assistance, and whether our residents qualify for some of that assistance. We are just this month actually launching a grant program where we provide up to $5,000 to residents and businesses who have either been impacted by these events or are making resiliency improvements to their properties to try to protect them in the future. And we have applications now available, and we're encouraging residents and businesses to apply to receive that assistance.
Let me go back to the politics. I got an email from someone who author of The Imperfect Union. The mayor must not be seeing Mr. Youngkin's signs in his own neighborhood and folks handing out literature at the Delray Farmers Market. So we've got the other side of that. I ask one more question about this? Is water related?
Yard signs don't vote, unfortunately.
That's true. I have a water related question I want to go to. It's really D.C. and Arlington, but you're on the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority. The district is just about to spend $10 million to buy land in Georgetown at the foot of the Key Bridge. And the folks who want a gondola to go over alongside the Key Bridge from Arlington to D.C. Want that space to be the landing spot, the old Exxon thing at the base of the bridge on the D.C. side. Do you know anything about this? Do you think a gondola thing sounds interesting? Is it some people laugh? Business people in Georgetown say it could be very good, and it ultimately could be a site for a metro tunnel, a new metro tunnel, into Virginia from D.C. for the Blue Line.
Yeah,
gondola, yes or no?
I've certainly been reading these reports. I think anything that can help provide new transportation options is a good thing for this region. I know we have been experimenting a lot more with ferries from Alexandria, trying to provide additional ways to get across the river. The river is typically the challenge, and anything we can do to get people across there quicker is a good thing.
Our guest is Mayor Justin Wilson of Alexandria. Needless to say, what most people in Alexandria want to talk about today is flooding. Here's Jeannie in Alexandria. Jeannie, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Mayor, I have two questions for you regarding the flooding in the city. The first is, as the city attempts over the next 10 years to mitigate the flooding throughout the city, is it possible to divert more of the recently awarded federal money to these efforts to accomplish this more quickly? Shouldn't this be the number one priority of the city for this money? And two, if the city protects and saves more of the permeable land that still remains undeveloped, will this not help prevent more flooding?
Well, first of all, on the second question, absolutely. Any permeable surface is good for preventing flooding, and reducing impervious surface is part of our strategy for addressing some of these flooding challenges. In most redevelopment efforts that occur in the city today, we're actually reducing the amount of impervious surface and increasing the amount of a surface that can absorb water in those redevelopment efforts, and that's long been a requirement of the city. And so that's certainly a focus. As far as the first question, one of the challenges with using more of the rescue plan money for these flood mitigation projects is actually a timeline issue. So the legislation has a timeline when the money must be spent. And so these are large infrastructure projects. You know, one of the larger projects in our flood capacity projects is a Hoofs Run bypass, which is a $60 million project. That's basically an elementary school for us. And if you think about how long it takes us to plan, conceive, budget, and build an elementary school, it's usually the better part of a decade. And these kind of projects are the same thing. And so our ability to spend rescue plan dollars is somewhat limited by the timeline, the deadline that the feds have put together. That being said, we are looking very much forward to this potential infrastructure bill getting through the House and getting to the president's desk, because I think that will give us a more resources as well as with a longer timeline to try to address some of these challenges. But in the end, it's going to be a combination of any resource that we can possibly get. But unfortunately, it's going to take some time. We're working everything we can to try to accelerate these projects and get them done as quickly as we can.
COVID? I think Loudoun County is the only major jurisdiction in Northern Virginia that hasn't made a decision about school and mask and vaccinations. Fairfax just announced, the public schools announced that taking effect in October, the 24,600 employees will have to be vaccinated or have proof of a weekly test. Alexandria Schools this week, and I know you don't run the schools, voted to have required vaccine tests by August 28th or weekly testing starting in September. But it's unclear exactly how it's going to work. The superintendent, Gregory Hutchings Jr., is mandated to figure out how to do it. Do you think Alexandria school system has done the right thing requiring vaccinations and tests?
Yeah, we actually put out a joint announcement today between the city and the schools, reflecting that on the city side, we're going to be requiring our employees to be vaccinated as well. And I know that the schools are doing the same. I think it's absolutely the right thing. All the data shows, when they do surveys of the unvaccinated around this country, that the way we're going to get those remaining folks who are unvaccinated vaccinated is through these kinds of mandates. Until it gets to a point where these folks have to get vaccinated to do the things that they do in a daily life, whether it is getting on a plane, going to work, picking up their kids from school, whatever.
Going to a bar,
they're not going to do it. And I think this is the way we're going to get it done. In Alexandria, you know, we're well over now 70% of our population with at least one dose. And to get those remaining folks, this is going to be part of that strategy. And so, I strongly support what the school board has done. And I hope we'll move quickly to get it implemented.
Here's Janice in Alexandria. Janice, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, since you're talking about vaccinations, I would like to tie it in with this proposed $500 monthly payment to the working poor. Are they going to be required to be vaccinated? And following up on that, I take a terrific aerobics class through Parks and Rec. Is everybody going to be required to be vaccinated attending classes such as that?
Yeah, we have not yet discussed any vaccine mandates for anyone beyond our staff. So we haven't been in a position where we're talking about people who are attending rec centers or anything like that. I imagine that will be a conversation that we will get into in the fall as all these programs get back in person. I think that's an excellent suggestion and one we will consider.
Do you have authority to require that the customers of city services be wear masks or be vaccinated?
In city facilities, absolutely. We have required masks in city facilities for some time, and we've restored that several weeks ago. Okay. So absolutely, we would have the authority to require vaccination in city facilities, no question about it. I think that's a conversation we will continue to have, and certainly part of the path out of this, for sure.
Well, we got an email from Teresa who said, last night the Alexandria School Board met to vote on a vaccine mandate for teachers and staff. There is no timetable for vaccines and testing to begin and no guidance or response about what happens when a classroom has to quarantine. I'd like to know how the mayor I'd like to know what the mayor and city council can do about this, and in this case, the mayor.
Yeah, so our health department has been working very closely with ACPS on guidance to how to handle when there is, someone testing positive, supporting their efforts to do the kind of surveillance testing that I would certainly support in our schools to detect potential cases in the schools. And we're going to continue to work very closely with them to give them all the best public health advice they need to make the right decisions to protect our kids. I have two students in my household in the Alexandria City Public Schools, and I think everyone wants to make sure that we keep our kids in school, we get them back in school, and then we keep them there 5 days a week full-time this fall. And I think that's going to require that we do all the best public health recommendations to make sure we keep everyone safe.
The school starts Tuesday in Alexandria, is
correct.
That correct?
Yep.
It's as I understood what the school board voted, they voted to start requiring proof of test by August 28th, with weekly testings to begin in September for employees who are not vaccinated. But then it also left it open to Superintendent Hutchings to maybe fudge those dates if necessary, just the sheer ability to start doing it that quickly.
Yeah, I think everyone supports trying to get this done as quickly as possible. Ideally, you don't have anyone that's being tested weekly because you have everyone getting vaccinated. And hopefully the prospect of that will encourage the final few folks on ACPS staff who have not gotten vaccinated to get vaccinated. We hope the same on the city side as well, and we'll be rolling out a very similar program.
The previous caller mentioned your guaranteed income pilot project,
yep,
where you're going to do 150 Alexandria households, lower income households, for a two-year period, are going to be receiving $500 a month, no restrictions, and that will be monitored to see how, I think, for the two-year period, how you can better do social programs to help families and individuals. Is that what this program is? I don't want to go too deep. I know it's very complicated, but give us the highlight.
Yeah, this is one of the ways we are spending the first tranche of our nearly $60 million of rescue plan money. You know, one of the things we heard from our community is, how do we address those populations that were the most vulnerable during COVID? And for us, these are the folks who were just below, just above the federal poverty line. These are folks who got hit just a body blow because of COVID, because their employers, closed shop, and they were the ones who were dealing with food assistance and housing assistance and all the different programs we had to put available. And part of this program, part of the idea here, the experiment, is to see if through these payments, these monthly payments for 24 months, we can try to create that resiliency for these residents who are right at that federal poverty line so that they're not as vulnerable in the future.
Excuse me. We have less than 2 minutes left. Let me ask you quickly, for somebody who wants to be in on the lottery for this program, what's the simplest thing for a person to do if a family wants to be in the program?
And we have about 30 seconds left.
We're going to have information out very, very soon over the fall. We're now working with a number of community providers to get that all ready.
Okay.
Our guest, Justin Wilson, is the mayor of the city of Alexandria. When do you plan on returning?
I should be back on Sunday.
Did you work for Amtrak? Did you take the train to Vermont?
I did not this time. My son took it this time. So he was up here.
Amtrak is coming back. That's a good thing.
Wilson, thank you very much for joining us. And that's it. The Politics Hour is produced by Sydney Grannon, and our managing producer is Inge-Lise Schroepsdorf. The maestro of our phones is Bruce Romer. Our engineer today, Kenny Pirog. Tom Sherwood, big plans this weekend?
Well, I don't think the weather looks so good. I'm just going to hang out.
Well, we actually allowed you to
come out. I'm glad to be back in the studio. Thank you,
Coach. I was about to say that allowed you to get out of the house. Now we're ordering you to get back in and stay safe. And thank you all for listening, and you stay safe. I'm Kojo Nan.
The Politics Hour with Kojo Namdi is produced by Sydney Grannon. Our managing producer is Ingalisa Schrobsdorf. Our broadcast engineer is Rashad Young. Today's engineer was Kenny Pirog. Mana Kashfi oversees all the content we make here at WAMU. For past shows and more content, visit thepoliticshour.org.